Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. Now, I should say, if PNWA, the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, they offer a we host a writers conference every summer in. This will be in SeaTac, in the SeaTac area of Washington, Western Washington. And if you are someone who has a book that you plan to pitch this summer that will be done and pitchable, if you know that this summer you'll be looking for an agent and or editor for your book, I encourage you to head on down to head over to PNWA.org, and sign up for their Leap of Faith for the 2016 Writers Conference, because you get it at a considerable discount and you have additional opportunities to pitch to twice the number of agents that you would agents and editors that you would otherwise. It's a great deal. They've never done it before. I think it's only going to be available for another week or two, so I think the end of January. So again, if you live in the Northwest and you think you'd want to attend a writers' conference this summer, you aren't going to do better than the PNWA, so head on over there. It's PNWA.org. I should say for myself that if you live in the Pacific Northwest, I'm going to be teaching a one-day seminar at the Whidbey Island Writers Association's Whidbey Island Writers Conference on Saturday, February 13th. This is an all-day class called Craft and Confidence, an Author's Masterclass. We're going to be talking about craft, we're going to be talking about marketing, and all important, what is confidence and how do we find it and how do we keep it? So you can sign up at Whidbey Island Writers, Whidbey Island Writers, or just go on my website. I have a link to it there. Oh, all right. Well, today's guest, Mr. Elliot Pattison, has done something that I encourage so many people to do, which is to take his varied and disparate interests and bring them all together. He's a man who has a love of world travel, and he, according to him, has traveled a million miles on this planet. I got to find out how he pulled that off. He also has a deep love of history, fiction, and a rather profound compassion for people of all walks of life. And he's taken all these interests and combined it into a fabulous and pretty prolific writing career. Author of many historical mysteries, Edgar Award winner. His most recent book, well, it'll be coming out soon, Blood of the Oak, is a fascinating look at, is the fourth installment in the Bone Rattler series, and is a fascinating look at life in pre-revolutionary America, just on the cusp of revolution, and it's just awesome. And he's here with me today to talk about all these awesome things. Elliot, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So, Elliot, you have traveled a million miles, a million. I wonder how many I've traveled. I bet it's about 1,000, if I'm lucky. All right, so you traveled a million miles. So you went all over the globe. Was this during your years as a lawyer? I know you started your professional life as a lawyer.
A lot of it was driven, sort of started out professionally as a lawyer, where I was doing international trade work and international investment work. And there are many, many, years when I would fly, across the Pacific 20 times, be in Europe, every other week. I would have some years like that. And so it added up pretty quickly. But I've been able to, hit every continent except Antarctica.
Wow. Well, you're going to have to get there before it's too late, my friend. You got to finish this. So, all right. So let me ask you this. Where did you grow up as a young fella?
On a farm in the Eastern Shore of Maryland.
Oh, boy. Okay. So the guy?
The peninsula by the chip between the Chesapeake and the Atlantic.
Okay. So you were a farm boy. And then you got yourself a degree in the law, and now you found yourself jetting all over the world. How did your view of what it is to be a human being change at all because of those travels and adventures?
Well, you know, when you start out in any in a career, you're sort of focused on the career, and you're so you, you sure. know, you're, you know, so here I was, you know, educated mostly in Boston, and mm-hmm. you know, out of the sort of industrial West milieu, but and I right. was thrust very quickly at an early age into developing countries, into sort of what we would call severely depressed economies and highly undeveloped economies. And that was really eye-opening. I mean, it was, you know, so suddenly, I couldn't tell you, it wasn't a sudden date, but I mean, very much
right.
became a world citizen and, you know, yeah. was no longer just sort of a narrow-minded American who only understood the street that he lived on, you know.
Right. Right. And so what does that mean in a way? I mean, I've heard the term and the idea of being a world citizen, but what does that mean to you in terms of your everyday life? How does that affect how you make decisions from moment to moment?
Well, you know, good question, but I would say, first of all, that, you know, the context for the information that I seek out in terms of, you know, news or watching developments
right.
is very, very, it's global, right? It's global. So I pay, in fact, a lot more attention to news that comes out of Asia often than I do to news that comes out of the United States.
Right.
You know, friends all over the world, you know, much more, I feel more sort of accountable in my daily actions in terms of where I buy things from and who I'm buying from. You know, it translates into a lot of subtle ways.
Right. And when did, so I must tell you, I edit Author Magazine, and so it's a magazine that I do a lot of interviews with writers of all genres, but if I wanted to, I could have a magazine devoted only to authors who are or who have been lawyers. There's enough of you guys out there that I could have an entire, you know, and it would cross all genres too, the authors I interview. So what I've wondered about this, although I've come to my conclusion as to why so many lawyers go into writing. But for me, I've decided, and you tell me what you think of my theory, that it's because the lawyers must tell a story with the facts to make their case. Both, in many cases, lawyers have the same facts, but they want to tell different stories. And so in that way, you are a storyteller, although a slightly different kind. What do you think? Is that part of the reason many lawyers are drawn to it?
And this phenomenon goes back even if you look at 19th century writers, a lot of them were lawyers.
Really?
I totally agree with that. I think, and just to embellish, I would say, you're making a case, you feel lawyers are trained to, first of all, communicate well, right? A good lawyer has
right.
to be a good communicator. And that sort of feeds itself in the sense that you want to keep being a better communicator. And then you're always looking for, as you say, a case to argue. And very much my first series, my first novels were the Inspector Shan novels set in Tibet. And those novels are very, very strongly focused on making the case for the Tibetan people.
Right.
In terms of being a writer, my writing career, I've written ever since I was in college, ever since I was in high school.
Not fiction
that was published anyway.
Right.
It was essays, it was book reviews,
sure.
it was articles here and there.
Right.
And so I was always looking for, ways to expand that communication. And I was always interested in fiction, but I had written 4 different business and legal books and sort of felt it was time to make a broader case, to embark on something radically different. And I was thinking about a mystery, but then the part of me that's the advocate had felt for years about the need for the West to better understand what China has done in Tibet. And then I realized that I could make, I could combine those. I had this epiphany that I could combine those passions, as it were, and develop this successful mystery series based in Tibet.
Yeah, and so when you started writing that, so here you are, your first crack at real crack at fiction, I assume your first serious swing at it,
yep.
although you're a person who's steeped in language for his adult and sounds like your early life too. What was the biggest What was the biggest thing lesson you had to learn? What was the biggest hurdle you had to get over to really understand how to make to write a work of fiction that came together and was successful?
There's so many. Of course, I'm sure you understand. There's so many factors that go into good writing. I would say, if I thought about this as a technical matter, that it was editing, it was keeping things lean. It was not, you know, lawyers have a tendency to say too much, right?
Yeah.
And so it kind of ran counter to those instincts, those lawyerly instincts. And I really, as a lot of famous writers have said, it's easy to write something long, and the hard thing is write something short, you know? So there's that aspect. And then otherwise, it was sort of building the passion into the work. And I believe, and you alluded to it, I mean, you know, I really strongly believe that good writers have to have a passion about their subject matter.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Well, I can't agree more. It drives me crazy when I saw my sons going through elementary and middle school and high school, the way writing was taught, which was generally, I would say to their teachers, as probably the one like writer they maybe who was coming into the room from time to time, like, just let them write whatever the hell they want to write. Every book you teach that is held up as an example of great writing is an example of somebody being passionate about their series, not their subject, not someone who just wrote what they had to write. I just don't think really great writing happens until someone loves what they're writing about. I don't think it's possible.
I totally, absolutely. And you can tell it when a writer isn't really that passionate about their work. I just did a little essay for an anthology that Writer's Digest is doing, or Publishers Weekly, on the writing process. And I talked in that about how, you've got to see the wonder in what you're doing. You've got to have a spark of like a miracle, you know, driving you. And that's what, you know, you talked about building my various sort of bodies of knowledge and experience. I mean, I think a writer, I also, you know, strongly disagree with the point that writers should only write about things they know about. I think writers should use what they know about. They need to be on a journey the same as their readers are on a journey.
Yeah.
What you know is your foundation. But you build on that something that's really fresh and something that's really new. And I always, even though I have two series, and you could say, well, sort of same old premise. Well, they're not really. I mean, each of the books in the series has a different, you know, premise. And I set out very deliberately every time I write a new novel to target someplace I haven't been before that will require me to learn something more. And I, you know, keep that learning process going. And my goal is to have my readers, you know, just as excited as myself about learning what's going to be on the next page. And, you know, because I weave with historical series and with a very, you know, sort of richly colorful Tibetan series, a lot of local color. You know, people are, you know, learning all the time about Tibet or early America as they read.
Well, I started learning as soon as I was reading this book. And it is steeped in all kinds of detail specific to the time that surprises me. And I love when details come up that go against the current of what I had learned about that time, but which seemed so natural in retrospect. And see if you can follow me. What I understand about humanity now, living in the 21st century, just being a human being, when I see certain specific details introduced in history that make sense, not based on what I'd learned about history, but what I have learned about humans today. Does that make sense? In other words, it fits what I know a human to be, but I forget about that when I read history because it leaves out all those tiny, delicious little details.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's why I have a fierce passion about good historical fiction. And I think history texts, you know, nonfiction history texts that kids get in school are so sterile. They get worse and worse every year. If they even have history, I mean, some students, you know, graduate high school without even taking history. It was dropped from the Common Core. And emphasized again and again and again. But I think part of the problem is, you know, that people are not excited about history. They think it's all a bunch of crusty old white guys or a bunch of charts or a bunch of statistics and data. But these were, you know, very much living people. I've done a number of posts about this. I mean, I think, you know, like I have a theme of the Scots and the Iroquois Indians. It's very much a dominant sort of, you know, in some cases a plot line, the interaction between the Scottish settlers and the Iroquois, the woodland tribes. And, you know, I talk about how, you know, we never see in the history books, but I know absolutely that, you know, there were times when suddenly at a Iroquois campfire, a Scot started playing a bagpipe.
Right.
And how did everybody react to that? Or
right.
Scots would go in and see the Iroquois playing lacrosse. And then, very sort of exciting game. They had a lot of appeal to the Scots, I think, because it was sort of militant, and, you know, sort of a lot of, you know, very physical attributes. And,
right.
and then suddenly the Iroquois smiles at the Scot and throws him the ball, and, you know, off they go. You know, it's all
yeah.
kind of really wonderful things. I mean, that's in our DNA, and we never hear about that in the history books.
No. Well, life is big. Ellie, I was just talking to my son because I homeschool my oldest son. He couldn't handle youngest son. He couldn't handle school, so I had to homeschool him. And we're right now reading. Oh, good Lord, we're trying to read People's History of America, and it will disavow you of any patriotism you might have been harboring in your heart before then. But as I was reading it, you know, and it's pretty tough, I got to say. But as I was reading it, I thought, you know, life is so big. And any story you tell about history is going to leave out 99% of all that was happening. There's so much happening. It's not just the massacres, and it's not just the dates and the time. There's so much going on, and it's all connected. It's all connected. You know, you can't pull one thing
and
out
the other,
without the other.
Absolutely. And this series, okay, and it really is the very broadest premise of this series, and especially this book, Blood of the Oak, you know, is based on this sort of recognition that America, you know, didn't happen overnight. That the United
right.
States government wasn't formed, you know, in a 3-hour meeting in Philadelphia.
Right.
You know,
right.
people, we had to struggle. And I talk about this I always have author's notes in my books, and at the end they sort of talk about what I'm writing, you know, why I wrote this book, and you know, I talk about how. Before we began even to conceive that there might be a separate nation, people had to begin to understand what it meant to be American. You know, and these
yeah.
were people began to realize they were no longer Europeans, that there was something
right.
very special about this land. And with my people, with my characters, of course, the influence of the native tribes plays a big role in
yeah.
helping them to understand that things are very different in this country.
Yeah.
And that's all very exciting. I mean, they were all these guys. It wasn't a bunch of crusty old guys in a room. It was guys like my protagonist, you know, young Scott, you know, young Iroquois, you know, Iroquois warriors, you know, old stationmen from the tribes. I mean, all kinds of people, you know, that led to America. And it was a culmination of you know, a million plus stories and events.
Yeah. I think I have a guest here or a caller who would like to ask you a question. Let's see. Jeffrey, is that you?
It is I, Bill. Happy New Year to you, my friend and your family.
Thank you very much to you as well.
And Happy New Year, Elliot.
Thank you.
My best
you have a
wishes
question?
To you, first of all, to you for unparalleled success with Blood of the Oak. And I'm also quite engaged in some important causes of my own. And relative to that, my question to you is, with the years of experience of your most admirable mission and cause for the people to bet, what have you gleaned, learned over the years that are some of the most effective ways to get the word out?
How do you get the word out? Thank you, Jeff. That's an excellent question. How do you get the word out so people actually listen, Elliot?
Well, I'd like to think that, certainly books like mine play a role. I mean, I don't want to, you know, I don't think I have an overly inflated view of you know, of my audience, but I mean, there
right.
are, I know because I get emails. I mean, one of the fun things about what I do is that, you know, I have with my website, people can contact me from all over the world, and I have people say, on the Tibetan side, they'll say, I get emails like this on a regular basis. I never understood the issues in Tibet until I read your books. And so,
Right. Okay,
so there's, you know, at least those people are beginning to understand. And I usually, and some of them will say, what can I do? And I'll say, well, you know, here's the address for the International Campaign for Tibet. You know, or you can write your congressman, you can go, you know, get active in your community. I mean, you know, and so, I mean, I think it's, look, there's no easy way to get the word out. You have to sort of, it's like no easy way to be a writer. I mean, you sort of slug it out and stick to it and persevere. And we try. And as I get, you know, I've been at this a lot of years at this point. I mean, we look for events or we look for, you know, ways to extrapolate, you know, getting the word out. I mean, you know, so it's always a challenge. It's a question that will always be out there. You know, what's the best way to get the word out?
Well, and here's something interesting, and there's a level to this that we can never quite measure. And I when I interviewed the author Richard Bach, who wrote, well, among other things, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, and he reached, you know, millions and millions of people. And he said, you know, and he met a lot of them, but of course, a lot of them he didn't. And he said, you know, you're going to affect people as a writer, but you're not going to meet them. Someone you never know is just going to come along and find your book and be affected by it. And the thing, and so even with your series, people email you and say thank you. But then the thing you don't even know about is them going and talking to somebody else about it, because they're going to be at some party, some dinner party somewhere, and someone's going to mention Tibet and they say, "Well, I read this interesting book," and then the conversation is going to spread that you might have started, but you don't participate in. But it's happening. It is happening.
Yeah, I'm sure we've all been part of that that cycle as readers. You know, we get so excited about something and talk it up.
It is, and it's gratifying if you can tune into it. I think it's, you know, just as a writer, the money is nice, and I guess if you get it, it's nice. But there is something delightful about reaching these perfect strangers and connecting over this thing that means something to you. I think it's lovely.
Which is also tied up in sort of the motivations for writers and the confidence and their level of confidence in their own voice, and how do you deal with rejection after rejection after rejection. You know, my books, you know, I went through the whole process. You know, the first series, Inspector Sean, Skull Mantra was my first mystery novel, rejected by every publisher. And I still felt like, I thought my voice was still, you know, important. It was important. I had a message that was important to be heard, and I wanted my voice to be heard. Kept at it, and then, you know, and finally, you know, when I finally got an agent who's located in the Northwest, you know, she said, "Hey, you know, I know exactly who to send this to." And like within a month, I had a contract with St. Martin's, and you know, who'd already rejected. They had already rejected it. It's just a matter of, so, you know, I found a guy, a wonderful editor, who said, "I totally get this, and this is extraordinary." You know, all the other, you know, rejection slips, the ones that, to the extent they wanted to say anything, they would, you know, they took time to say something. It'd be like, who would ever read a mystery set in Tibet? You got to be kidding. I mean, you know, well, I can't think of somebody out there who wants to read it, you know?
That's right. Well, and I mentioned Richard Bach, but you may not be surprised to learn that a 10,000-word book about a talking seagull, or seagull that wants to learn to fly, was soundly rejected by the entire New York publishing world. And then eventually there's a whole story about how it found its way to press. But I know many authors who have the same story of editors saying, "I can't imagine why anyone would want to read this, and the book sells 100,000 or a million or 50,000 or whatever. If they can't see it, they can't see it."
My Sean series, they're in 20 languages.
So, Elliot, I know you're also passionate about history, about the teaching of history, and how it's not really, you feel that it's fading as a national interest. So why do we need to learn it? I'm going to play devil's advocate, actually, because I'm now having to teach history to my son. But why is it so useful? Why is it necessary to us? Because you're doing it in your book. You are teaching history in your book, whether you mean to or not. You're certainly doing it.
Very deliberately. I mean, I absolutely look to expand the knowledge of history and get a younger audience excited about history. I mean, I gave a speech a couple years ago at the Gettysburg College. It was a 3-day conference on historical arts and both painting and writing. And I said, you know, stop and think just for a second, would you please, the audience, you have all this DNA that defines who you are, okay? But that DNA existed somewhere else 200 years ago. Okay, yeah. Where was it? Do you know where your DNA was? I'm very passionate about this. If you don't, in my view, I really believe that if you don't know history, you really can't know yourself. I mean, you need to know, and it's certainly on a more macro level, if you don't know the history of your country, how can you really know your country? There was a wonderful quote from Michael Crichton, who's gone now, mm-hmm. but he did a couple of historical novels, and he said, if you don't know history, you're nothing but a leaf that doesn't know what's on a tree.
Is that how you feel? I mean, were you a history buff when you were young, or did you come to your understanding of history later in your life?
I'd say I was always interested, but it became a passion more in the last, later in life, last 30 years, I'd say.
Do you feel like your understanding of yourself has deepened as your understanding of history has deepened? Have you felt it in the present day as well? Just a sense of who you are.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think learning how. Yes, I do. I mean, short answer, yes. But okay. Learning about going back to the prior point about sort of the human aspects of those who lived in the past. Okay, I mean, you begin and I'm an avid reader of firsthand chronicles from the 18th century. Okay, and you begin to feel the humanity of these people, and you begin to realize that they faced an awful lot of the same dilemmas that we have today, just that we have a different technology, so they get presented to us in a different way. But a lot of the same moral issues, a lot of the, it's striking to me how similar humans are through the ages. I think it is important to understand we're all sort of, we've been in the same boat for all these, centuries and centuries. And not recognizing that, I think, does limit us.
Yeah, it reminds me, I had the opportunity to interview Jane Smiley, who's a passionate advocate of the novel, and also a bit of a novel historian, actually, and she really believes that one of the great gifts fiction gives us, but it reminds me of exactly what you're saying about history, is it teaches us compassion, because what you were just describing is understanding humans who are very different from us in that they lived in a very different time, if nothing else, plus all the other differences, and yet finding that connection of similarity, which doesn't appear on the surface, but is living there beneath the surface. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you peeled away all of our trappings of technology and the material culture we live in, that we're not that different from those who lived, 200, 300, 400 years ago.
Everybody, you know what it is, Elliot? I don't care where you are or when you lived, you want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to love and be loved. Everyone wants to be interested. Everyone wants to feel validated and worthy. I don't think that's changed in 10,000 years. I can't imagine.
I agree totally. I think in a little bit of an extrapolation of that there is also that everybody has understood justice. I really firmly believe there's sort of a natural justice that's in the genes of the human race. And my books are very much about that. I mean, because my dilemmas, my protagonists, and the mysteries they resolve are all things that have to be dealt with sort of outside of formalities, formal systems,
right.
And they're spiritual dilemmas, or there's acts of what we would call crimes that cannot be addressed by government. And we find a way to discover justice in what you might call a natural way.
Right. That's awesome. Well, Elliot, I have one more question for you before I set you free. And what I'd like you to do is finish the sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what? What has it taught you?
Well, I would get repetitive of what you just said, but I would say compassion.
Excellent.
Okay, because it's all about linking with other humans and understanding the many, many layers and subtleties and dimensions of compassion.
I love it. That is a great answer, Elliot. And the book is Blood of the Oak, which will be out March 1st, wherever fine books are sold, March 1st of 2016. But I assume our devoted listeners can pre-order it now on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or similar sites. Is this so?
I'm sure they can. Yep.
Okay. Excellent. Well, Elliot, I wish you the best of luck with this book, and perhaps I'll have you back when the next one comes out.
Yeah, I'll have another one out next year.
All right. Keep on writing, Elliot.
It's been a pleasure. All right, Bill. Thanks very much.
All right. Take it easy.
Take care.
Yes, indeed. Compassion is true. I can't agree with him more. In fact, I have often said on this very show that if a writer can only develop one quality in themselves, compassion would be the best one. I think it was what makes you the best writer you can be. I will be back next week, of course, talking to a fellow named Paul Selig. Ooh, that is going to be interesting. And the week after that, I'll have the suspense writer Tammy Hoag on. But until then, all you got to do is find something you love and do it. And do it again. Life, baby.